all across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Good day. I'm Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today here on Veterans Radio, and thanks for joining us. We've got some interesting stories for you. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web, veteransradio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. And finally, PuroClean. PuroClean is the paramedics of property damage. It provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, biohazard cleanup. It also has a focus on veteran franchisees. You can learn more about them by going to puroclean.com. Hey, we want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a friend, Robert Neer, Dr. Robert Neer, U.S. Army. Bob, how you doing?
I am well. Thanks for having me.
Well, Robert and I are on a couple of boards together and working on projects, and he recently published some information and some research he was doing for his PhD dissertation. I said, ooh, this is interesting. We got to follow up on this. But before we get into the academic study stuff, Robert, you were in the U.S. Army from June of 05 to April of 2010. How did a nice kid like you end up in the Army?
You know, I was a romantic and I wanted to serve my country. I also didn't mind the benefits that they were offering for college.
Now, was this a family thing? I mean, did you have dad or uncles who served? Where did the desire come from?
Yeah, so my grandpa, who I kind of grew up with, he served and he didn't talk about it much, but I knew he served. And besides that, I really didn't have a lot of people around me that served in the military. I just knew that I could not afford college, and I wanted to go down a route that was paid for. But I also, like I said, being romantic, I wanted to serve my country and just serve people.
Well, Robert is a father, a husband, the blended family has three kids. All of that kind of comes together post-service, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your education, because I mentioned you recently received your PhD from Western Michigan University. You also hold a Master's of Public Administration and from Pennsylvania State University, a Bachelor's of Science degree in Leadership from Grand Valley State University, and a General Studies Associate degree from the Central Texas College. Now, this is a kid who couldn't afford college, right?
Yep.
You kind of went all the way on your education. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I had no desire to continue to go. You know, I got my first degree while I was still just getting out of the Army, which was an associate's degree, and I had a desire to understand leadership a little bit better, just from my experiences in active duty and a little bit in the National Guard after that. I sought the leadership in business program through Grand Valley. And after that, you know, I was in the public service at that time, working for DHHS in the state of Michigan, and I had a desire to understand public administration a little bit better. I had my GI Bill left, so I doubled down and got it done. And I had no desire to go back, but the program director, Dr. Kieran Fogarty. I kind of came across him in a work professional setting, and when I was working in nonprofit field, and he just a great leader, good person, and he was the director of that program, kind of recruited me. I ended up going through the program. It took me a little bit longer than I thought, because I was the deputy director for the state of Michigan's Veteran Affairs for the 4.5 years. So that took quite a bit of my time. So it was postponed, and I had to jump back into it after I left that role, and I was able to get it done, finished up in this last year. So I wanted to chase the program, which was a PhD in interdisciplinary health sciences. And it helped me understand a lot about research the systemic ways that you do scientific research to make sure that you're doing it properly and you are, you're not biased and you're doing it in a way that supports the mission of what you're trying to accomplish with your research. So just a wonderful program. I was very blessed to take it. And I'm happy to be done with it.
Yeah, I'm sure. But the reason we're talking is because we're going to talk not about, oh, this is just my opinion. We all got opinions, right? This is research-based with some conclusions, some information that I want to get across to folks. But that's the key, to realize that there was rigorous research put to this work. But before we get there, I kind of jumping in a little fast here. Talk to us about your time in the Army.
Yeah. I was in from 2005 in June after high school until April of 2010. I got done with basic training and AIT, and I was told that I was going over to Seattle. I wasn't too keen on being on the other side of the nation, so I thought, how do I get on this side? And one of my drill sergeants said, well, go airborne and you'll be at Bragg. So I went airborne. And I got stationed in Alaska, even further up north.
You gotta love Army intelligence, right?
Yeah, that's the way it worked. So I went up to Alaska, and we prepared. It was a brand new brigade, the 4th of the 25th Infantry Division, an airborne brigade that was stood up in Alaska in Anchorage. And I think 2004, we deployed in 2006, the end of 2006, I found myself overseas in Kuwait for a month or so, and then I went up into Afghanistan during the second surge. We were up there for about 15 months. We came back. It was a very effective deployment. We were very busy working the COIN mission, counterinsurgency, under General Petraeus during that time. And just like I said, very busy, very successful mission. We did lose a lot of people. I think we lost 79 from our brigade during that deployment, not including our external assets from the National Guard and Reserves. So just very busy. We got back 11 months of downtime, and I was stop lost, involuntarily extended, and sent back over to Afghanistan. I was there for a little over 11 months. Almost 12-month deployment, came back, and I got out of the military, and I ended up joining the National Guard for 2 years and staying right next to my home in Michigan and kind of chasing academic pursuits in life with my young family at the time.
Well, with two tours in Afghanistan, you really saw, some of the worst of that 20-year war. It's one of those things that never leaves you, does it?
Yeah, no. And just to clarify, I was first deployment in 06, 08 was in Iraq, and my second one was in Afghanistan. But yeah, you're absolutely correct. That it's a different culture, different world. I was very blessed to be a battalion commander's driver, so I was able to see quite a bit and work across a lot of the country and be out there with a lot of the people and get to know people. So it was a lot of exposure for a young lad.
Well, and, somebody who just out of high school seeing all this really shapes you. And part of that shape was sort of this accidental pattern of, well, I want to go learn more about this, so I'm going to go back and get some more education. And you use the GI Bill, as I say, from an associate degree to bachelor's degree to a master's degree and ultimately to the PhD, which gets us to what we really kind of want to talk about is the research topic that you took on, and tell us a little bit about the topic, which was assessing the relationship between combat exposure, wartime service, and barriers to substance use disorder treatment in post 9/11 vets. Kind of strikes home. Tell us how you got there with this topic.
Yeah, you know, I'm coming back from both of those deployments. We had a really good kind of out processing where individuals would go through a pretty rigorous psychological assessments, and everybody knew what to say and how to get through it. And, you know, you saw a lot of alcoholism. You saw a lot of people getting kicked out of the military after our deployments. Between my first and second deployment, when we came back, our brigade was kind of known, which wasn't great, as having a really high DUI count for our soldiers. And it was just unfortunate. You know, it's always been an interest of mine to see, like, what can we do? Why are people not taking advantage of all these amazing services that are out there? Is it stigma? What are these barriers? Like, and when I was talking to my director or my academic advisor, when we're discussing what kind of dissertation we would chase, this topic came up, because it always has. I want to see, how do we help these people get through these barriers, even if they're not real? They're just perceived barriers, but to them, that becomes a real barrier if it's perceived barriers. So I kind of wanted to assess and see what we could do about it. I didn't make it that far, but we did find a national data set through SAMHSA, which I'll talk a little bit more about here in a little bit, that had most of the data that we needed based off of what barriers they perceived and why they weren't seeking treatment if they did have a substance use disorder. So it was something that was just extremely interesting. You know, it's been around, seen a lot of people go down the wrong paths and not get treatment for whatever reason. So I just want to try to do my part and expose what we could do a little different, maybe to minimize people not going to seek treatment and seeing that there's options for them.
And I'm going to explain this acronym. You can then use it the rest of the way, which is substance use disorders, or SUDs. And you were trying to sort out from this large national survey on drug use and health, what factors influence getting SUD treatment or not? And those are the barriers you're talking about. So what kind of barriers did you find when you parsed all the data?
Yeah, absolutely. So this study was found, and I should have backed up a little bit and talked about it. So the primary research questions were, what is the relationship, or what was the relationship, between post 9/11 combat exposure and perceived barriers such as stigma, access to care, and financial constraints that would influence veterans' help-seeking behaviors and substance use disorders. And that's pretty specific, because I wanted to assess the modern warfare and post 9/11. So I did not look at all veterans all the way back. I only took the study sample that we had for post 9/11 veterans out of that larger sample. The next question was, what was the relationship between demographic factors such as age, gender, race, and ethnicity, income was another one, and treatment-seeking behavior among these post-9/11 veterans? So I was really focused on those two areas, and it's extremely significant, because this study was, the goal was to address critical gaps in SUD treatment access for post-9/11 veterans, because each generation has, you know, a different, I wouldn't say ambiance, but a different you know, experience. They have a different culture. For the most part, veterans are pretty similar, but that generational differences do make a difference with their experience and, you know, a little bit more wisdom with time from our Vietnam veterans leading the path and advocating so much for all these benefits that maybe all these post 9/11 veterans aren't taking advantage of, if that makes sense.
It does. And one of the things that was a key finding that you had was sort of the degree of SUD prevalence between 9/11 combat veterans, 9/11 non-combat veterans, and the general population. Explain to us a little bit about that differential and why trying to sort out what the barriers are to treatment, why that's so important for combat-exposed veterans.
Yeah, so like I said, the three main were stigma. They're in the national data set, which was, like I said, I'll go through it all here in a second. But the national data set that we used had three primary categories. It was basically financial, It was your stigma or culture around it. And then the last one was access to care. So logistical barriers. So stigma, financial constraints, and access to care. And those were the main perceived barriers that are going to kind of influence whether or not people did seek treatment or not. And what we found was that anecdotal costs were, or financial constraints were kind of a key finding that were a perceived problem, and it made veterans 28% less likely to go seek treatment if they had those perceived barriers or financial constraints in their life. We did find that if you had over $75,000 a year in income, you were 3.42 times more likely to seek treatment if you knew, acknowledge that you had a substance use disorder, than those who were less than $75,000, which was pretty significant considering, you know, it's 3.5 times more likely to seek treatment than those who are less than 75K. And then there was no indication. One thing that was that we found, which we were seeking to see if there was an indication or a significance, was that veterans who were exposed to combat in overseas or whatever their self-designated combat exposure, that there was no significance in them seeking treatment or being more likely to seek treatment.
That's a really, when I read your research, I was really surprised by that, because combat exposed veterans were almost double likelihood of a SUD situation than non-combat veterans, and, you know, I don't know, 2.5 times or something greater than the general population. So, you know, the guys with the problem seem to be, okay, well, they're combat exposed veterans. So that probably is going to factor into why they don't go and get treatment. But that didn't turn out to be a driver at all, did it?
No, and that's the thing with this study. I should talk about it real quick on the data set that I use, so that way people can reference it. The data set is a very well-known National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is also NISDA. And it is from SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration for America. They do this very large survey across the whole nation on an annual basis. And from my study, there was about just over 59,000 participants in the survey. But I focused on, well, also out of those 59,000 participants, about 1,980 they had service in the military. And 838 of those, out of the entire 59,000, 838 were post 9/11 veterans. And then post 9/11 veterans who served in combat was about 450 out of those 830. So that was, you know, just to give you a kind of idea of how big the data set is and how well known it is, before we dive into the results that you're discussing, because what we did find was that, veterans, which let me reference this. I believe it's 9.6% of the general population had a self-identified substance use disorder. Non-combat veterans from the same population had a 12.8% likelihood of said prevalence, and combat-exposed veterans was 21.5%, meaning that 1 in 5 veterans self-identifies that they, or acknowledge that they have a substance use disorder.
Yeah, again, you'd think, well, okay, I understand why the guys in combat, direct combat, have a higher likelihood of substance use disorder. But that then gets me to, well, they're probably the guys who are getting the most amount of treatment. But it's sort of different than that. The data tells you a different story. Tell us what the data tells you.
Yeah, the data, it didn't, as I mentioned earlier, there was no significance in any of the perceived barriers or likelihood that combat veterans would seek treatment at a higher rate. And we don't know the reason for that. I don't have that data at my fingertips. There's many assumptions that we could say, like, for example, those veterans are more, they know they have an issue or a problem. Because they're more likely to know because they have better out processing, like what I had when I was getting out, to acknowledge that, you know, these things are issues, as opposed to maybe those who don't deploy. So we don't know like what those are. But some of the big barriers that, you know, you think about in the military, that is in my literature review, with culture and military culture, is, you know, you're tough. You're supposed to be a tough person. You don't ask for help. There's promotion potential that may go away if these things come to light. There's a lot of potential issues with you mentioning it in the military culture, even though it's presented in a way that it's okay to ask for help. You'll see, I don't know if you've seen some of the policy changes, but even one just recently that might have negative unintended consequences is the one that holds E7 and aboves now to the same standards as E6s and below when it comes to DUIs and their punishments, meaning that they can be demoted just as quick as the younger, you know, the lower ranking individuals. And that doesn't seem like much, and it seems like a no-brainer that it'd be a good thing, but that does compound the challenges in the substance use field. You're gonna have more people hiding it. You're gonna have more people not seeking mental health support and treatment because they don't wanna be exposed, which could be detrimental to their careers, right?
I do wanna get to your recommendations, but there was another set of key findings that you've had from parsing the data that I thought was interesting and we should kind of tell people about, and that there was a race and ethnic pattern that you were able to discern if I understand this right, white veterans, non-Hispanic white veterans were roughly twice as likely as black veterans to seek treatment. Is that, am I reading that right, or is that the percentage of folks with SUDS prevalence?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. So the people that are going to seek treatment based off of this data set that was ran in 2022 showed that race and ethnicity absolutely played a crucial role in treatment-seeking behavior. Specifically, as you mentioned, non-Hispanic white veterans had the highest treatment-seeking rate at 6.2%, while non-Hispanic black veterans had a much lower rate, which was 3.8%, and Hispanic veterans sought treatment at a similar rate at 4.5. So that shows you that there are some cultural barriers, not necessarily that may be based off of race and ethnicity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's important to realize those cultural barriers exist because you can't have the same, if you will, recommendations or one size doesn't fit all when you go through this and see, yeah, different groups are being impacted different ways. And before we run out of time, I want you to talk about your recommendations, if you would.
Oh, yeah. So two more things to mention, and I'll talk about the recommendations because they're key in there, is that age was also a strong predictor of treatment-seeking behavior. The age range 35 to 49 had the highest engagement rate at 6.9%, compared to those younger veterans, which is only 2.5% seeking treatment, and similar rates, but it was definitely 35 to 49 is the highest. And then on the other hand, there was no statistical significance between male and female, but males were a little bit more likely, 5.4% compared to 4.8% of the female veteran population. But with our key findings, you know, it was pretty impressive to see all these things come together, and you know, it kind of reassures your gut feeling of what's going on in this space, and are there issues that we could be avoiding by giving recommendations that we know are backed by research. So we already talked about the key findings of post 9/11 veterans that were combat exposed being two times more likely than the general population to have a substance use disorder. We talked about male and female and the high and low rates of age, racial disparities, and the higher income being an increased likelihood of seeking treatment by 3.4%, but also the perceived barrier reduced likelihood of seeking treatment by 28%, meaning that, as we talked in the beginning, that if you had less, or if you perceived that financial constraints were going to be an issue, you were 28% right off the bat less likely to even seek treatment. So some of the recommendations that I made Could I jump into those?
Yeah, please do. I think there's five of them here that I want you to cover.
Okay, yeah. So the first one, obviously, is to expand financial support by covering indirect costs, such as transportation, childcare, because we found out the ancillary costs are kind of a deterrent when it comes to seeking treatment, because insurance doesn't necessarily cover everything. They would maybe cover the treatment, but there's a lot more complexities going on in everybody's life that maybe we should be cognizant of when we're getting people into treatment for substance use. And I know there are some programs out there that are very effective, but I would advocate to promote those. But also funding for gender specific with integrated care, meaning that we would bring all care together, not just their substance use disorder care, but also their mental health care, their physical health care, in one location, so that way that individual can have a full supported substance use treatment experience. We'd also, our second recommendation was to reduce stigma by utilizing veteran-led campaigns and peer support while increasing access to confidential treatment options, which that's already kind of being done, and there's research, a lot of research being done in those areas, but I just want to encourage that and say the data supports it. We need to continue to increase it. The third was to enhance cultural competence by training providers in culturally tailored care. We know that individuals that come in that maybe had a sheltered life or they've had limited exposure to different cultures with ethnicities or races are less likely to have a strong relationship with individuals of different races and ethnicities. And so what we recommend is focusing on these specific needs of minority veterans and female veterans, because that's going to help build up these providers by training them appropriately on how to interact and engage with most effectively. And the fourth one was to improve access by standardizing trauma-informed and integrated care models by expanding telehealth services. So we strongly believe there's a lot of research out there that shows that this is, it already works. And you can see a lot of that in my literature review. You can see it out there by yourself in your own research, just by showing and exploring a little bit that integrated care models and telehealth services are really opening doors that weren't there before for geographically displaced veterans that may have limited access to care. And then the fifth one, it also helps with the financial constraints as well. So it does help, mitigate the high financial constraints of treatment from facilities when you can do some of it from home. And then the last one here was I recommended to address disparities by targeting outreach efforts for minority and low-income veterans and kind of debunking myths, which I know we're already working towards that, but we're not quite there with a consistent message across the nation. And we just need to strengthen partnerships between the VA and community organizations, which once again, the VA is really working hard to do this. We're just not quite there yet. We just got to continue to advocate and push that needle because as we see in research across the board from many colleagues and individuals out there doing this kind of work, that there's more to do.
Well, I'll go back to, we all have a gut feeling on some of this and hey, we need to get our veterans who have substance use disorders in the treatment. Well, we may have that gut feeling, wow, this is a barrier, that's a barrier. That's why it's nice to have the research done and have, give some support to gut feeling or changing in that gut feeling. We've been talking to Robert Neer, a PhD, airborne artilleryman, U.S. Army for, I think that's about 5-6 years, a couple of overseas deployments, and afterwards made his way all the way up through the academic roster to ultimately get a doctorate, and this is some of the dissertation research that he's done. Robert, did you finish this up where you thought it was going to go, or did it give you I wasn't expecting that?
It was very in line with current literature that's out there. There was, a few findings that were really interesting that we had discussed throughout this time period, but I was really hoping to see if I could expose the probability or likelihood that a combat veteran is going to seek treatment or not, when there's really not any significance in the study that I was able to find. But I would advocate for other researchers out there to, maybe do more qualitative work, not necessarily all quantitative, like what was done in the study, so that way we could really see what are the perceived barriers We're looking for that aha moment of how do we break down this wall and get people that need the help into the care they need so they can be productive members of society again. That's really all we're trying to do.
Well, it's certainly a noble goal, and we appreciate the time that you took today to talk to Veterans Radio listeners and explain a little bit of this to us, so it kind of reinforces some of our gut feelings, Robert Neer. I really appreciate the time that you gave us today, Bob.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim. I can't say enough how much I appreciate what you all do on the radio. I just love to listen and love to hear it, so keep up the good work, and thanks for having me on.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org. We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm and with a national practice before the VA, can help you on your claims and your appeals. It can be reached at legalhelpforveterans.com or 1-800-693-4800. And PuroClean, a leader in property emergency services. It's the paramedics of property damage, providing water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold and biohazard cleanups. You can reach them at puroclean.com or 800-775-7876. We also want to thank our local sponsors. This would include the Charles S. Kettles chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America. That's chapter 310. VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423, the American Legion Irwin Preskin Post 46 in Ann Arbor as well, the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, and certainly the National Vietnam Veterans of America Association. You can be a sponsor by going to veteransradio.org, clicking on the About Us and our sponsors, and help us out. Keep this program alive for the 21 and 22 years. Keep us going for another 20. Thank you.